Listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that didn't land man on the moon this week. I'm Andrew Page and he's Scott Phillips. No, I'm not. I'm Scott Phillips. He is Andrew Page. We didn't land on the moon this week, did we, mate?
No. Bitcoin price landed on the moon almost, but that's... See how quick I got that in there this
week? That was remarkable. I don't know, shall we 30 seconds, mate? Let me check. Nope, less than 30 seconds. Well done.
That's a record. That's a record.
Well, the good news is we got that out of the way, so we don't have to talk about it ever again.
Exactly. Out of the system,
mate, you know what's... So let's start with a tangent. Apparently, and this is... I was saying this before we recorded. I didn't realize this was happening. And all of a sudden on Twitter, I see, watch live, man landing on the moon again. I was like, wow, I didn't realize that was happening. And then... I kind of got distracted, and then I didn't see another single headline about the thing the entire time. And it's funny that I guess what I want to observe is the thing that was so remarkable, like absolutely stunningly remarkable 50 years ago. Now it's kind of interesting when it was live and then no one cares about it. We've all moved on to Taylor Swift or whatever else we've talked about this week. And there's just something kind of nice. We're going to talk about some tech companies later, but there's just something kind of nice about the whole, you know, the thing that was so monumental becoming almost pedestrian, because that's just what happens with progress.
Yeah, it is so fascinating. I've often thought that if you time traveled someone from 100 years ago to the modern era, their brain would explode within an hour, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's just, there's too much to take in. But it's completely normal now that I can have this like magic bit of glass to access all of humanity's knowledge and talk and see anyone on the planet and have probes go to the distant reaches of the solar system. And it's like, it's a Tuesday. Yeah. We've sequenced the genome of yet another animal and, you know, modifying things at the molecular level. And we're now creating silicon that can think, you know, like it's a mind blow. It really is. The future's exciting. I was just going to say the future's exciting.
Yeah. Well, the present's exciting, right? I mean, I was telling this during the week with someone and you know, there's, I know housing is a big deal and we've talked about that a lot. And I don't really intend to talk about it again. Other than I know people are kind of really super fixated on it. I'm like, yeah, you know what? That's an issue. By the same token, the increase in living standards writ large over the last century is just so phenomenally, phenomenally huge. And it's not to say, therefore, the problems of now don't matter. I've never said that. I never want to imply that. But it's kind of like someone said, oh, yeah, well, I can't get housing. I know I might be able to carry this thing around in my pocket with all the world's information, but so what? Mm. I'm like, I'm not entirely sure you got that proportion right. Like, yes, you need housing. You've got it, by the way. It might not be secure. You might not be able to afford it as much as you want, all that kind of stuff, which is real. But to blow off the last century of technological improvement, like, oh, yeah, who cares? Like, I get people fix that on their own problems, and I get that sometimes when you've got stresses, you know, I don't want to be insensitive to that. But when you kind of blow off all the things you just talked about on the basis of, yeah, well, so what, I want to buy a house. Like, oh, I'm not sure you can just do that. There's a lot going on, a lot that's happened, a lot that's happening right now. Imagine 10, 15, I've said so many times, the iPhone's 15-ish years old. Like, that's not, even when you talk about the glass in the pockets, like we kind of take it for granted. You don't have to go back to 1924. You can go back to 2004. Yeah. And the 20 years of innovation and technological just explosion is phenomenal.
Well, that's what really floors me is it's the compounding nature of things is that, you know, progress has just is just accelerating, right? And it's sort of new breakthroughs beget even more breakthroughs and it moves so fast. I mean, we are currently living through at least half a dozen paradigm shifts right now, right? Yep. One of the, I forget, was it Andreessen Horowitz or someone, Silicon Valley dude said, the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed.
Yeah.
And I love that quote. I love it so much because when you look at all of the big sort of breakthroughs in time, I mean, there's an instance at where it hits the mainstream. But what you realize is that, you know, for the previous 10, 20 years before that, there were plenty of garage tinkerers and the technology was there, so to speak, but there was a difference between someone inventing an internal combustion engine and the first Model T rolling off the production line. There's a very big sort of difference there. So, you know, one thing I was just going to say on your point of appreciation, I think it's a good one. Like we are so much better off than the richest person from 100 years ago. My gripe would be just to again be the glass half empty kind of guy. Is that I think the frustration for many comes, it's not so much that we aren't all richer. It's just that those riches haven't been evenly shared or fairly shared. Is probably a better word. Fairly shared. In other words, it is potential that with all of that technological breakthrough and productivity gains that we would all have a much higher standard of living.
Yeah, right.
We've got the deck of billionaires out there, and yet we've got a record number of people living in their cars. So I think that's the delineating factor for me. Not that we 100%. All have so much stuff here, but the way that is sort of allocated among society.
That's absolutely true. Speaking of which, mate, not everyone has access to strawman.com, which, as I know full well, but I need to remind you, is a private online investment club, which I believe you founded and started, although I haven't seen proof of that yet. You may just be taking credit for someone else's hard work. I believe that's true. Is that right?
It is. And if I was going to steal someone else's work, I tell you what, it'd probably be Tesla or something a bit more ambitious, Atlassian or something. But yes. And where are you from again? What do you do?
The Motley Fool.
Motley Crew?
We provide investment advice to individuals. Fool.com.au. thank you for asking. I appreciate it. Shameless plugs all over the joint right now, and that's just the way we roll around. Mate, let's get on to the news of the week. There's been a lot going on. Starting with the macro, as we do. Big news yesterday. I say news, I'm going to put news in inverted commas. Roy Morgan, the research mob, are very credible, very capable, very serious people, do a really good job. The numbers, though, can be a little bit large and interesting. They reckon, as of yesterday, 1.6 million Australians are at risk of mortgage stress. Mm-hmm. Massive, massive, massive number. At some point, I don't know if... Hard to know. Based on a sample, based on some arbitrary allocations of household spending, all that kind of stuff, 20% at extreme risk, another 12-odd% at risk, at some risk of mortgage stress, based on a proportion of household income being put towards the mortgage. And I thought that was interesting, mate. Again, the numbers kind of, as with all things, you know, I talk about this with interest rates, but even with this sort of stuff, it's not even the numbers that matter, it's the direction, it's the change, right?
Mm.
So we see more people struggling. More people tipping over those arbitrary points. The direction, whether it's 1.6 or 1.8 or 1.4, I won't say it's irrelevant because there's real people in those numbers, but, you know, it's a best guess estimate from a research mob who, you know, are absolutely putting their best effort into it, but you can't know for sure.
Churchill said something about, he's talking about death, but one death is a tragedy and, you know, 1,000 is a statistic. So right. it's kind of the same with this, right? 1.6, 1.8 million people in stress. But
it's very true. Stuff out. But mate, what I thought was worthy of comment was just that, as I said, the change in that number. Also and again, we're going to get retail sales this week. We're recording this on Wednesday morning. Unfortunately, before both inflation and retail sales numbers are out this week. So we'll know more this time next week. But it's interesting that, a couple of things, I suppose. The fact that prices keep going up continues to put pressure on households. We've talked about that a lot. Whether, by the way, not just mortgages, but renters and everything else. It's also true, I think, that if you look at the so-called mortgage cliff as some sort of phenomenon at a national level, didn't really eventuate, hasn't anyway. But there are thousands of mini cliffs. You know, every day, every week, every month, someone rolls over from their previously fixed rate to a new variable rate. And in doing so, that number does tend to, it must by definition impact on individuals, right?
So it's happened to a friend of mine just the other day, speaking to them. And they were like, oh my gosh, what I have to pay per month is just 4X'd.
Yeah, right. And it's crazy. So you kind of think about that and think, okay, well, that's happening in the background. So there are, by definition, more people who all of a sudden had this, or used to have this money left over. Now they've got to find a way to put it. Now, hopefully a lot of them are already doing that. So, you know, anything's kind of justifiable, explainable, but it's a reminder that while we talk about the headlines a lot and the official cash rate as a single number, the roll on, I guess I'm an optimist, mate, you know this, and our listeners certainly know this. I'm just mindful that 2024, I think, could be tougher than many people had presumed. The thought that once interest rates peak, therefore everything after that's going to be better. It'll be slightly better for most people if and when rates start to fall, and as inflation becomes less of an issue, as you've said many, many times, prices aren't going down, they're just not going up. So there is no relief valve here. If rates stop going up and inflation stops going up, we're just stuck at this higher plateau. Nothing declines yet. Rates will come down at some point, probably this year, but maybe not. Maybe by a bit this year, maybe not. So there are hopefully some easier times ahead for individuals and for the economy. I just thought it was worth thinking about the impact on the economy right now, and the fact that I just don't think, again, I'm not trying to worry anyone. I don't necessarily think there's an investing takeaway from this. But I would be very, very, very loath to think we've passed some peak and therefore we're on the way down again, because we're just not there yet.
Yeah, no, 100% agree. I want to sort of underline the significance of that number. Let's take it at face value, 1.6 million. Well, there's only something like, I mean, there's it's Australia, 25 million people, but it's something like 10 or 12 million households, right? And we also know, so I'm going to do a bit of extrapolation here. And I don't know if they, when they talk about people, they're combining like two people in a couple or whatever. Yeah. So there's a bit of generalization here. So let's call it 12 million, to keep the maths a bit easier, households. And let's say that 1.6 million of them are in stress. So, you know, the other third rent and the other third own their house outright. So they're never going to be in rental stress, mortgage stress. As a percentage, that's what, 38% or something of households with a mortgage in mortgage stress.
So they're on their numbers, mate, they have it as 32%.
Okay, there you go. Okay. So, I wonder if they must have combined couples or something like that.
I assume they must have, too.
Yeah. Okay. But that is a huge number. Now, again, let's sort of step back here. What do they mean by rental stress? It's sort of, in some way, in fact, in every way, arbitrarily defined as some threshold above some threshold proportion of total household income. And it's not as though you go from paying 59% of your income towards housing to 61%, and it's a big change. But you do have to draw that line somewhere. And it shows is it doesn't predict anything, but as I've said many times, it emphasizes the fragility of household budgets. So that if there is a health situation, if there is a change in employment circumstances, if anything like that, there is just a lot less padding that might otherwise be available. So yeah, and like my mate, I mentioned my mate before, I mean, they'll be fine, they're not going to be kicked out of their house, but I tell you what, they're going to have to tighten their belts in a lot of other areas.
That's right.
And in fact, that's what he was complaining about. and you know, they'll probably still be fine, but as I say, it's that fragility angle that concerns me. And it's, again, let's take their numbers, 38% proportion of mortgagees that are in that situation. That is a big number, man. That is a huge people. And that is a huge number of people. You often forget, and this is worth underlying, not to sort of scare everyone, but with markets, prices are determined at the margin.
Correct.
It'd be a bunch of, it doesn't take 38% of people to default on their houses to send property down, I don't know, 20% or whatever. It could take 5%, right? Because a lot of people just pull their head and go, well, I'm not selling, I'm just going to hold off for the time now. But then you get the people that are forced selling. Yep. Then you sort of get the psychological factors kick in. And again, I'm not saying this is what's going to happen, but I'm trying to, again, underscore the significance of 38%. It is a very, very large number of households. We haven't had a recession yet. As to your point, everyone was calling for one and didn't happen yet, at least. But I think it's not out of the realm. It's not a crazy thing to say we will have a recession at some point.
Right.
You know, I would bet a large sum of money over the next 10 years there'll be a recession. And maybe it's on the ninth year, or maybe it's in a month. I don't know. But when it happens, there'll be a lot of households walking into that in very precarious situations. And it's a concern.
Yeah, because cycles happen, and that's the key one. I think, to my mind, mate, I don't want to pretend or imply I don't care about people who are in mortgage stress, but the bigger issue for the rest of us and for all of us is the impact on the economy, as you just talked about. I mean, that the reality of money being sucked out of spending. Now, the money's going to go somewhere. You've made that point before, but the money gets sucked out of spending by those households who all of a sudden have to pay more interest on their home loans. That spending doesn't happen in the economy. Now, for an economy that's, you know, when it grows at 2%, that's a good result. From 2 to 0 is not far, and from 0 to anything negative then becomes recessionary territory. I mean, if you suck 2.5% of spending out of the economy, you take an economy growing at 2% to an economy declining at 0.5%. It's not that simple, but it's not miles away either.
Not far off.
And I mean, there's government spending and other stuff. So, I don't want to... Yeah, take it as a directional thing rather than absolute. My point is, it doesn't take much for positive growth to become negative. Remembering, of course, the last quarter, we only grew at 0.2%. Now, you know, continued interest rate increases during and since then Since then? No, not since then. September. No, there was November. So yeah, one more in the new data. People rolling over from fixed to variable. Again, I'm not predicting anything at all. By the way, I saw an article in today's paper or yesterday's paper saying the leap year might save us from recession, which is fascinating. Wow. Adding an extra day, which you think about 90-day quarter, you add an extra day, that's more than 1%. So yep. It's possible that the extra day's activity and spending may save us from, if not recession, because maybe the next quarter is not negative either. But and these things are small impacts. By the way, too, plus 0.2 and minus 0.2 are effectively the same number for all intents and purposes. They're not on very, very large economies. The dollar values are huge. But if we were to, you know, during the Swan Rudd GFC response, the so-called cash splash, they avoided recession by the tiniest fraction because the economy grew at 0.1% in that second quarter. Mm-hmm. Had it been minus 0.1%, we'd had a capital R recession and everything else. Do we really think that the circumstances are that different? And I'm going to say,
and the numbers are estimates too. Let's just be clear here, right? They're not. It's not something like a hard objective number to 10 decimal places. Yes.
Which is that they're extrapolations rather than pure estimates. They're not just finger in the air. They're taking sample data and extrapolate. But yes, you're right.
But it's an estimate. Not,
yes, yes. And so you're right. Is it a big deal? Is it not a big deal? I mean, honestly, the growth number is not a big deal. If it's plus 0.1 or minus 0.1, it's kind of the same. I will say it's a massive deal if we do have a capital R recession because of the psychological impacts. The fact that everyone goes, oh my God, we're in a recession, let's then do something, as opposed to, oh, we're not in a recession, thank goodness. The behavioral psychology stuff, and yes, I bang on about it a lot, and I frankly don't do it enough, as I've said before, is enormous. You know, plus 0.1. And the other thing, by the way, if you have a single quarter where you're minus 0.5%, next quarter's plus 0.1, net-net, you're still minus 0.4, but you've avoided recession. Yep. You have two quarters in a row that are minus 0.1, you're actually still better off.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's a capital R recession means the next time around, people freak out, they stop spending, all those things happen.
Well, people stop stop hiring. All these ripple effects.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it's all headline-based. So anyway, I just wanted to kind of flag that.
Do you know the other thing that's, I guess, touching on the point we mentioned earlier, and this is more longer term, but again, in regard to the future already being here, just not being evenly distributed, there's plenty of very smart, well-regarded people that are talking about, I mean, this is why we've seen such the big pump in NVIDIA and a lot of tech stocks, is this AI revolution and maybe a robotics revolution not too far behind that. You're going to find structural changes in the economy where it's just harder to get a job because people can be so much more efficient. There will be entire industries that go the way of the horseshoe maker and of the blacksmith. You know, what happens when you can think about, let's just take one example. Let's just take call centers. I've now got a voice-activated chatbot that's just as good, right? And I've got a million of them, and they cost me a fraction of what I currently do. Let's take self-driving vehicles, which are already here. I mean, this is largely a legal impediment at this point in time. But when you've got the logistics transport network being far more automated, example after example after example, that is going to be a much in the same way that the work-from-home phenomena has been a shift. And they're not, you know, shifts have good consequences and bad consequences, good for some people, worse for others, but it's change. And it's something that it's easy to get very starry-eyed with some of this tech. And I think what we all tend to do, the other saying is that we overestimate it in the short term and we underestimate it in the long term.
It's so true.
Which is so true. So true. You go back to any sort of, you know, the mobile phone, the internet, whatever. It's just sort of like there are the starry-eyed optimists like, this is going to change the world. And 3 years later, it's like, not really. And then 10 years, far more than you would ever imagine. And you know, this is likely to happen, I think, in our lifetime. So I don't know what my point is out of all of that, but it's sort of, change is coming. And change represents risk, but I guess to be optimistic, is change does represent opportunity as well.
Yeah, that's my take, mate. I'm a little more optimistic than you are as a general rule, but also in this case as well. You look at, you know, I think it was the turn of the 20th century, something like 80% of people worked in agriculture.
Yep.
Now it's 3 or 6 or something ridiculous.
Yep.
And we've still only got 4% unemployment and we're stupidly richer than we were. And yes, there are downsides and I kind of feel like I need to always clarify and specify that. But, you know, the we find ways to spend our money, and people find jobs in those areas, and so on and so forth. And we're better off for it. The pace of change may be more dislocating than in the past, and that has, frankly, geopolitical issues as well as local political issues and everything else. But you know, maybe at some point we're only working 4 hours a week, or maybe 90% of us haven't got a job. But I don't know. I am far less concerned. Think about the introduction of the spreadsheet in 1980, right? All these accounts clerks were suddenly made unemployable, and there's still 4% unemployment. You know, we find ways of, and this is, by the way, this is why standard of livings have gone up so much, because you don't have to have 80% of people laboring away for minimum wage on a farm. You've now got people working as physiotherapists and nurses and, you know, hairdressers and whatever, pick your you know, creatives doing movies and films and making TV shows and whatever else. The reality is those things tend to create their own jobs because our demands increase, our wealth increases, and smart people who with a profit motive say, I think I can solve for that. I think I can give them something they're going to want to spend their money on. Yep. And that's kind of how this stuff rolls out. That's the interplay of needs and wants, the interplay of rising standard of living and increased wealth. If you've got a couple extra dollars in your pocket, you might want to spend it on a new thing someone's got for you. You mentioned those glass things in our pockets. A new bloody iPhone, it's $1,500 or something, which is on one level crazy. When I bought my first Nokia 121 for $100, you know, in 1990, whatever it was. But on the other hand, the amount of time and effort and energy we spend staring at that piece of glass, Warren Buffett calls it the most valuable real estate in the world, because it literally is the things you can put on that screen. The amount of time, effort, money we spend on that is incredible.
Yep. I guess one thing that I'm mindful of with all of that, we can't all be YouTube influencers, right? Mm. Like, so when the Industrial Revolution happened, we were humanity, a very big chunk of humanity, found refuge in the higher level occupation, the more, as you say, the more creative, the more thought-based kind of activities, the less manual labor things, because we had all these engines that could do things for us and just give us the strength of 1,000 horses. So that was all really cool. What might be a little bit different this time around is that there's no safe haven potentially for a lot of humans. It's not that there won't ever be a requirement for someone at the top, but someone at the top can command far more resources and productivity than they ever could before.
Yes, yes.
And while there will be new jobs that we can't even imagine,
yes,
not everyone can be Joe Rogan. So podcasting wasn't a thing that long ago, right? You know, but it's just a different dynamic. And sort of you think, okay, well, where do we go to next? You know, there was that, I think one of the parts of the argument when it's come up for a long time has always been, well, we'll all be artists, you know, but we've already seen that like AI can write better music and do really cool things with drawings. Like I think it's going to be a pretty radical transformation. It's going to play out over decades. So it's not something that's going to happen tomorrow, but it's going to, there is always upheaval and pain and disjointedness when these big paradigm shifts happen. So
particularly if they happen quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. And they have the potential to happen extremely quickly. I opened up my Gmail this morning and already there's like Gemini stuff being advertised.
Yeah, it's cool, isn't it?
You know, and it's sort of like, we were only talking about, you know, the first ChatGPT on this pod a bit over a year ago.
Right.
1 year.
Yeah, it's
1 year.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And it's like, and then what it's 5 years later look like, I can't even wrap my head around it. So, I think one sort of high level investment takeaway I have from all of that is that barring some radical change to society, maybe we all go to a UBI or some, I don't know, we're all led by a sentient AI that just sort of is a beneficial, a dictator or whatever, we may find that what we get is a lot more spare time, and that the notion of work is different, I suppose, in that, you know, we have more resources, we have more that we're able to consume, but something a 40 hour working week going 9 to 5 might be an antiquated kind of notion. I don't know. It's going to be wild, but I want to be someone who is an owner of capital. Because an owner of capital is far more likely to benefit. If my only value to society is what I can do through my work, whether that be manual or thought, and that's at risk of disruption, and that goes, what am I left with? If I am left with, if I have spent some time allocating capital to the kinds of entities that are likely to benefit from this, I might suffer personally in my direct income generating capacity, but my I will still have a pile of capital that's working very effectively for me. And that's always been, in fact, when you look at the richest people and the top strata of society, if you want to call it that, they are the owners of capital. And the capital base and the nature of capital has changed over the generations. But I'm sure in 30 years' time, the richest, most successful people will be those that have capital ownership in these big value-creating entities, whatever shape they may take. I rambled through that. Does that make sense?
It absolutely makes sense, mate. Yeah, and it has some social implications, by the way, but on a selfish level, you want to own some of this stuff because that's where, you know, to protect yourself from dislocation of labor, owning capital is a wonderful place to be. And by the way, for those who are raging at the podcast machine right now because of that, I feel your pain. And there are definitely policy changes. You mentioned UBI already, Ram, which is a whole different thing we may not get into. But universal basic income, by the way, for those who are wondering. Very selfishly, if you don't believe, don't trust, or aren't sure government are going to come to the rescue, owning capital is a nice bulwark against it. No guarantees, by the way, because I guess capital could be disrupted as well, or the gains may flow to a very specific subset of capital. But it is, you're much better having that capital, having that ownership of those productive assets rather than working for a quid, if only because it gives you that opportunity to have a second bite of that cherry. You're working for a quid and owning capital means you've got two goes at this one. If one is disrupted, you've got the other. If you only have one of those, then you're on the hook if things go badly.
Let me tee you up for a nice segue here. A good example would be someone who has lost their job, but 5 years ago made a decent investment into NVIDIA, right? So you've had this massive sort of value accumulation that you've shared in. So even though you're sort of worse off in one area, you're probably much better off on that because of the exposure that you granted yourself. And that is the really cool thing about equity markets. You know, pretty much all of the big ones are all listed. And even as an Australian, if they're overseas, you can take a part of these kinds of things. And it might be something to think about.
Yeah, for sure. Mate, let's...
The segue being there was we're going to talk about the Magnificent Seven.
Right, that's one thing. Right. I did have something else, but I'm going to put that aside and let's talk about the Magnificent Seven. We should talk about it because they've been really, really important and massive. I pause only because we've had the FANG stocks and we've had... You know, the media and the finance industry love to be able to put some labels on these things because it makes it relatable and investable, and there's already a Magnificent Seven ETFs and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I just...
You can go back to the Nifty 50, right?
Exactly.
If you go back a few decades, yeah.
So I'm gonna ask people to... I'll explain what it is in a second, but just be mindful that when we talk about this, we're talking about it because it's a thing. Don't get swept up in it necessarily. So the Magnificent Seven... are seven American companies that have been just going through the roof share price-wise over the past, I'm going to say a few years. Basically, these are the big tech giants of today that are just, we've talked about kind of the why almost without talking about the companies themselves. Let me just go through the list I own some of these. Amazon, Apple, Alphabet, which is the company that owns Google, NVIDIA, the chip maker, Meta, was the old business called Facebook once upon a time, Microsoft and Tesla. Now, these are called the Magnificent Seven. The reason they've kind of risen to prominence is the market capitalization, the value gains of these businesses are extraordinary. Now, to give you a concept of how big these guys are, there's a Deutsche Bank report that was out in earlier this month, February 19th. So there you go, about a week ago. Quote, the Magnificent Seven's combined market cap alone would make it the second largest stock exchange in the world.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
They are just phenomenal. The gains they've made over the past 12 months in particular has been extraordinary. It's worth talking about for a couple of reasons. One is we've kind of already done it, mate. You kind of touched on these are all tech companies, literally all of them. I mean, Tesla, arguably a car company. And again, I've talked about tech before, and tech is a stupid term, except that when you think about the way these guys are creating value, it is utilizing that technology in new and different ways. I've said before, I've talked about the NASDAQ as an index being the companies that are inventing the future. We've talked about why and how. Again, think about what these companies are doing. It is just remarkable. As a result, by the way, and we've talked about this in an Australian context, Deutsche also says, quote, sorry, I shouldn't quote yet. The US stock market is, quote, rivaling 2000 and 1929 in terms of being its most concentrated in history. Mm. Now, we're used to having half our market here made up of banks and miners. The US was much, much, much more broad only 5 years ago. Now, very, very concentrated because of the growth of these guys. Apple and Microsoft, close enough to $3 trillion US dollars of market capitalization each. It wasn't that long ago we were crossing $1 trillion. Will Apple ever get to $1 trillion with the headlines? Now it's at $3 trillion. Meta's not far away, Alphabet's not far away. These are just huge, huge, huge businesses. And I will say, mate, I am not gonna suggest there's no froth in the share prices. What I will say, I own some of these, I own of this lot, Amazon and Alphabet. What I will say is, if you look at the price earnings ratios, they are absolutely high. Absolutely elevated. But they're not stupidly stratospheric.
No, they're really not. No.
You know, there might be 30-odd times, but these businesses have grown like the clappers.
Yeah, Apple's 28. I'm just looking now.
Right. And so
even Tesla's 45.
These are not stupid nosebleed, can't possibly do it. So when they talk about 1929 and 2000, people think, okay, Great Depression, you know, dot-com crash, et cetera, et cetera. And again, these businesses could halve, and the P's wouldn't be cheap traditionally, right? A P of 30 for, I think Apple might be under 30. I think Meta's at about 30. If it was to halve to 15, that'd be market average. And yes, it would hurt shareholders. You know, a halving in a share price is never good. Yes, it would hurt the index, by the way, because how big these guys are. But if you kind of just consider that, you know, that's about, I suppose, as far as I can go. In 2000, the NASDAQ fell 85%. Because there were stupid valuations for companies. These might be too high. They might be a bit frothy. They might be a bit over the top. Or they might not be, by the way. But it's not like there is no basis for the valuations of some of these companies.
Can I just put that in context?
Please.
Clarify something here. You're right to stress that these are high multiples. When you look at the long, long-term average of the markets, what did you say, 15, 16, something like that.
Yep.
So when you see Tesla at 44, and also given the size of it, you know, if the Motley Fool can grow, could 10x itself and still not be on the NASDAQ, right? Strawman could 100x itself and still not even be on the Newcastle Exchange, right? So it's sort of, there is a lot more room to grow when you're small. When you're that big, yeah, there's still growth potential. Please don't at me all the Tesla bulls and stuff, but it is just much harder to grow. But I think the reason we sort of say it's not that bad is that A, despite their size, there is still pretty decent growth potential. But B, look at it comparatively. Let's go to the ASX. I think if we didn't have our local context, maybe we would be looking at these numbers and going,
geez,
that's a bit high.
That's so true.
I just did a quick search. Zero. Mm-hmm. The company Zero, the accounting software. The PE is 168.
Oof.
Prometicus, we've talked about a lot. Drink. The PE there is 130 or something.
Right, you know. Right.
The Altium, the chip designing software company, got taken over recently. Well, it's in currently going through a takeover offer, a very generous takeover bid from a Japanese firm. PE 74. WiseTech, another. You know, what do we? They had the Magnificent Seven. We had the our acronym?
Wax.
So this is the W in Wax.
WiseTech, Altium, Afterpay, Happen, and Zero.
Well, Appen's interesting.
Uh-huh.
Isn't it?
They have to pay too, by the way. Yeah, go.
Yeah, but with WiseTech, it's on a PE of 122.
Oof.
Can I just say for the record, I think every company I just listed there, I really like. I really like them. I don't own any of them, and that's why I don't own any of them.
Yeah.
But before you know that, if you think that makes me smart, it probably doesn't, because I could have sort of made a similar argument when they were all at a PE of 80, and it's gone up another 50%.
Exactly.
But it does, like each company has its unique circumstance and growth expectations and all the rest of it. But from as an Australian perspective, sort of seeing some headlines about the Magnificent Seven and the multiples they're trading, and you go, oh, geez, I wonder what they are. And you think, that's not that bad compared to what I'm having to deal with here on the ASX. So we whatever remarks you want to make about the valuation of the Magnificent Seven, if you want to take a local look of things, I'm just finding it harder and harder to sort of for anyone to rationalize these valuations. It's not that they can't be proven reasonable in the fullness of time, but as I often say, the asymmetry in the returns there is sort of really unfortunate. It's either they shoot the lights out and you'll beat the market, maybe 5% a year or something. They do what everyone expects, which is very, you know, what everyone expects, and you maybe get sort of the market average return by definition, or they fall a little bit short and you lose 30%. It's just the math's not attractive on it. But I've been really wrong on a lot of those stocks so far, so take it with a grain of salt.
And it's worth saying, you know, businesses like Amazon, I've owned shares in Amazon for quite a while, they had P's above 100 at some point previously too, and investors were right about those. So it's not to say you can't be right about these other companies. It's also maybe true that these guys have lower P's now because they're becoming more mature as businesses, and so there is only so much more growth left. And maybe, you know, maybe it is better to buy the high PE stocks when they're young and small and can still grow by, you know, 3, 4, 5, 10 times. Given the growth of these businesses, the profit growth of these companies, revenue growth, is still extraordinary for businesses of this size. They are reinventing the future or inventing the future. And that's, you know, almost your point before about the sheer pace of technological innovation. No surprise that almost all these businesses are using AI in some form or are benefiting from AI in some form. Again, not in a frothy way, like investors love these things, so the share price are high. I mean, they're doing things and that's actually adding to sales and profitability. Like they're genuinely growing, doing and using these things. NVIDIA is the one I'm least comfortable with, honestly, mate. And this is maybe this is going to, you know, someone will record this and play it back to me in a couple of years' time. They are making the chips that are powering the AI revolution. They have something like 90%+ of the market share of chips used in that purpose. That's exactly why sales and profit are through the roof. And they're growing like the absolute clappers. Now, whether they can continue to do that if and when other players come to market or other things happen, that's an open question. I have no answer to that at all, no view. But it's worth kind of saying that as much as they're benefiting from what's going on now, of the seven, they're probably the one I think that are least obviously have a moat that's protectable if things continue to innovate and change. So that's just my personal view. Again, like you, I've been massively wrong on this because obviously the share price has gone through the roof and I haven't owned the shares. Will it be their chips that are used in the future? I don't know. Will the growth be the same in the future? I don't know. And I don't really think it's possible to know. You might say, well, they're there now, they might keep winning, and that's not a bad thesis, by the way. But I couldn't. You know, I can look at Microsoft and say, well, we know what they do, we know what consumers and businesses think of them, we know they're, you know, are they, no one's protected from competition, but there's seemingly more defensible parts of their business. NVIDIA is the only game in town right now. At some point, when you're the monopoly provider, that's almost the biggest risk, right? Because you only need someone to come in and start doing it, and all of a sudden your business comes under some decent threat. Not unlike Intel, by the way, which was the only name in town in chips for a while until AMD turned up. So I don't know. I make no predictions, but they're probably the one I'm least comfortable with.
There was a wonderful animation I saw on, I believe it was Twitter, going back 2014, comparing NVIDIA and Intel. And Intel's at $140 billion market cap in 2014. NVIDIA's at 10. And, right. You know, it's an animated chart. And obviously one just shoots up beyond, just insane. And so now you've got NVIDIA at like 500. That can't be right. 500 billion?
Nah, well more than that now.
Oh, wow. So this chart only goes, oh my gosh, this only goes through to 2021. So
$1.97 trillion. That's 4x since that chart.
So, well, the reason I mention that is because it shows you back in 2014, you could have made an argument that Intel was the dominant player.
Correct.
And if there was some kind of chip boom, that they would be the major beneficiary of that.
Yeah.
By the way, you haven't done terribly in Intel, but you haven't done what you've done in NVIDIA. And so I think if you're going to invest in these companies, actually, there's people I know who really have a strong conviction on this because they've gotten way into the weeds. You can't invest on this because you think, I think AI is big and NVIDIA makes chips, so I'm buying NVIDIA. I mean, that is a recipe for disaster.
That's my concern, yes.
Yep, and that's what a lot of people do. So it needs to be that kind of, no, I understand the industry. I've done a lot of work on this. Here's their edge over competitors. Here's why it'll be maintained. Here's the market opportunity. This is what they'll capture. These are the economics they'll have. It sounds like a lot of work. It is a lot of work. But that's kind of where you sort of need to go with that. One other quick point I want to make on that chart, which is it gets me every single time because people do these things all the time, is that on something that is just an absolute to the moon rocket, the number of drawdowns along the way are gut-wrenching.
Yeah, that's true.
Gut-wrenching. So NVIDIA went from $200 billion to $100 billion over 2019, and then it had these other, you know, just massive, massive drawdowns. And it's
Quickly, Matt. So in 2021, so November 2021, $329 a share. By September 2022, $121. It fell by two-thirds.
Wow.
Over that period of time, every year. Yep.
The reason I bring this up is that we all secretly want the 10 bagger, the 100 bagger, right? Like, that's what we want. It's nice to plod along and get 10% per year. But, you know, by the way, you only need one of those stocks to really make the difference. No one gets it, though. Well, very, very few people do because the psychological toll of riding through that. And that's why I always say it's very easy to look back in hindsight and say, oh, you got lucky. Yeah, you bought Amazon in 2001. And I really bristle at those comments because I think, no, I take my hat off to you. I applaud you. That took such incredible conviction and strength of fortitude to be able to cling on through all of that you deserve every single cent that you made.
Yep.
And it is not for anyone to sort of point to that and go, look how easy that was. You bought something 10 years ago and you did nothing. Mm-hmm. It's like, you have no idea of the difficulty in that. And people that are able to do that just deserve all the credit and reward that come to them. But if you want to be one of those people, it's going to happen, right? It's going to, you have to be the person who can sit there in the last, 8 months, you've just lost two-thirds of your money, on paper, and then buy more, right? And I'm not saying you buy whenever something drops two-thirds, but full circle, if you've done the work and you understand this, then I'm all for you backing it. Otherwise, be very, very, very careful on just getting onto these hype trains. Because the other reason to that is not only that you're buying something without any sort of objective view, or at least trying to be objective view on value, is that when the drawdowns happen, your whole investment thesis was couched in number go up and number now go up. And so you panic and you sell. If you want to be a holder through that, you conviction, and through conviction comes through understanding comes through research. It's just, I'm sorry, there's no shortcut to it. And it's why there's only one Warren Buffett and, a handful of famous investors that we sort of like to talk about, because they are so exceptionally rare. But take the lesson is, I guess, my point.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Mate, speaking of Buffett, let's move on to him, because he released his shareholder letter last weekend. And Buffett writes, he doesn't speak that frequently to the media, off and on, doesn't speak to analysts at all, but puts his thoughts in writing once a year when he writes to the shareholders of Berkshire Hathaway. I am one, as our listeners well know. And it's one of those things that I think is worth just taking a step back from. It's not as exciting as NVIDIA. It's not going to change the world like AI. It's not even Bitcoin, believe it or not, Ram. But I think it's worth thinking about. He's written a whole lot of cool stuff this year. BerkshireHathaway.com is the website. Do yourself a favor, read the letter. It's short. I mean, the whole thing is, he puts like the company analysis and stuff, but his commentary letter, it's probably eight pages or something like that. I don't know what it is. It's really, really short. Very, very worth reading and worth thinking about. I'm going to share some quotes, but I wrote an article about it earlier this week. So I'm just going to share some of the quotes and maybe share my thoughts and get your thoughts on the same thing, and then you can add anything you want to that. But unusually, he spends the first page talking about his longtime business partner, Charlie Munger, who died last year. We did an episode, a Charlie Munger episode, late last year. So hopefully you got a chance to listen to that one. But he, and you know, Buffett and Munger both very, very humble guys, always gave each other massive amounts of credit. So no surprise that Buffett does the same here. But a couple of just thoughts about Charlie or Charlie's value and what he said to him. Warren quotes him as saying, "Warren, now that you control Berkshire, add to it wonderful businesses purchased at fair prices and give up buying fair businesses at wonderful prices. In other words, abandon everything you learned from your hero, Ben Graham. It works, but only when practiced at small scale," end quote. I thought that's, again, hopefully that concept of that quote, you know, buy wonderful business at fair price, not fair business at wonderful prices. That kind of echoes, it should be new to our listeners. It also echoes exactly what you said before, mate, about if you're going to compound your money in a single investment, it needs to have a long-term trajectory, because if you buy it because you want to turn 80 cents into a dollar, when it gets to a dollar, then what do you do? You've got to sell it and find another 80 cent dollar, right?
And maybe then you got to pull the rabbit out of the hat right. All over again.
Now, yep. As Munger said to Buffett, according to Buffett, it happens at small scale. I guess you can probably do that regularly enough if you try. In Ben Graham's day, who was Warren Buffett's mentor, for those who don't know, in the 30s and 40s, it was super easy because there wasn't the computing power, there weren't as many investors, there were more mispriced opportunities. He made a lot of money doing exactly this. These days, no, both at large scale, but frankly, in the days of, you know, universal information and computers, that stuff doesn't exist anymore. Buying wonderful businesses at fair prices because they can continue to be wonderful businesses for a very, very long time is well worth doing.
Yeah. Yep. Buffett said before on that, he's talked a bit about that before. He's brazenly, perhaps is the right word, sort of said that if he was, his biggest handicap today is the sheer size of the money that he is holding. And I think
that's too much thunder. I'm getting into that.
Okay. I guess I speak selfishly here. I guess talking about my own sort of investment journey. I think there's no one right way to skin a cat, but you've got to find something that resonates for you and something that you can sort of find a passion in. And I've gone through that journey where I used to be all about very high quality companies at fair prices. And I've sort of shifted more to the early Buffett kind of stuff. I don't know if it's going to end up being the right move or not. But I love that idea that they're still acknowledging when it's worth saying, because not everyone listening, in fact, I'm going to go out on a limb and say no one listening is a multi-billionaire who's got, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars.
G'day, Twiggy and Jenna, by the way. Yeah, that's right. But thanks guys for tuning in.
Well, it sucks to be the smallest fish in the pond in a lot of ways, but I'm flipping it around to sort of say, if that's you, you get to play in an area of the market that the bigger people can't, and that not even if they wanted to, they can't do it because of the capital that they've got, and that's something that I find great solace in that you have far less competition, so much less of the quote unquote smart money that you're competing against. And it's a point worth making, I would sort of say. Not to say push people in any one direction or that, but it is, I think those inefficiencies in the market are getting less and less over time, but they remain much more prevalent at the edges than they do at the top end.
Yep, I think that's a really good point. He goes on, mate, to talk about, and this again, just a bit of a Charlie Munger rap. He says, quote, "In the physical world, great buildings are linked to their architect, while those who had poured the concrete or installed the windows are soon forgotten. Berkshire has become a great company. Though I have long been in charge of the construction crew, Charlie should forever be credited with being the architect," end quote. I, you know what, mate, my strongest thought about that is actually just the humility of Warren Buffett. Like, you're Warren freaking Buffett, right? And yes, maybe he doesn't lose much by giving someone else some credit because he's still Warren Buffett and he's still going to have that halo. But when you kind of say, everything I've done over the last 65 years, you can kind of, you know, it's actually Charlie, not me. That's no, you know, I don't know too many other people who would willingly not only defer some of the credit, but effectively defer all the credit to the design of what has been the greatest investment conglomerate of, I'm going to say all time, certainly of modern times, to somebody else. Say, yeah, look, I manned the till. Someone else put the strategy in place. Mm. I think that sort of humility, frankly, is missing from public life, and we can do with a whole lot more of it. I don't have an investment takeaway necessarily, other than stay humble is a pretty good way to start investing and keep going on the process.
Humility is everything, you know, and he's just such a gentleman, Buffett. But I think it's just such, honestly, I don't think I know a good investor who isn't really humble. And not because it's a necessary, not because I just like, I think we like people who are more humble than those that are very braggy and arrogant and the rest of it. But my point being is that arrogance and hubris leads to disaster in investing.
It does. Yeah, exactly. You know,
it just does.
When you start reading your own press, you're in trouble.
Oh, you really do. And like how many times have we seen the pride before fall moment? The fund manager that's flying high, the AFR is all over them. Funds are flowing into their vehicle. They can't lose. And then boom, down 80% and never heard of again. It's the idea of there are old generals, there are bold generals, but there are no old and bold generals. And yes, I agree with you. It's just, it's always nice to see Buffett. He's always been very humble and very, very quick to sort of share praise and the rest of it. But I would just sort of say again, for you personally, if you're that kind of person that can't listen with an open mind and good faith to other arguments, and especially the arguments that are against your position, you're just not going to make it as an investor. Yep. I don't think. I'm not saying you have to agree with every person who argues with you, but you need to take them seriously. Mm. And speaking of Munger, he how many times has he made that point? You're rereading his book again at the moment, right?
Yes.
It's
just
sort of like you need to constantly challenge your assumptions. Mm-hmm. You need to constantly make the assumption that I might be wrong here.
Yes.
And if I am wrong, where am I wrong? You know, if you don't ever consider that as a possibility, you are going to walk into so many traps and in a way that probably makes it unrecoverable. So yeah, don't be arrogant, I guess.
The other thing I'd add to that, mate, just to really flesh out your point, not only do you have to be humble enough to realize, to really search hard for where you might be wrong, you're going to be humble enough to realize you're going to be wrong anyway.
Yeah.
And so while you can try and minimize the errors, you will still make the errors.
Yep.
And so investing accordingly, diversifying, dollar cost averaging, the things that you can actually do to avoid that reality of I've been as careful as I possibly could be.
Yep.
Buffett's bought businesses that have gone broke.
Yep.
Subsequently. Yeah. You know, this is
plenty of occasions. Yeah.
Right. If you think you can avoid that, then good luck to you. So, you know, the idea of, you know, the humility of making sure you understand the downsides of your own ideas, but also even when you've done as much work as you still can, you're still going to be wrong sometimes.
Mm.
And so investing accordingly, it's just necessary. And I think when you start to believe that you have all the answers, you stop leaving room for your own errors, as you said, mate, and trying to find them, identify them, but also simply saying, well, I think I'm right about this, but there's a decent chance I'm going to be wrong, so I'm not going to put all my eggs in this basket, or I'm not going to take this approach, or I'm not going to assume I'm right. If you set your course on, this is the only way this can, and we've seen this so many times, and again, it's an old Hackney one, and I apologize to Steve Keen yet again for mentioning this one, but Keen's gone, I've done the maths, the housing market can't but crash, so I'm going to sell everything, which he did. And then his response afterwards was, well, I would have been right if government hadn't changed. Now, what he didn't allow for was the fact that government might change. It wasn't his reasoning was wrong, or his analysis was wrong, or in a all things being equal economist world, he wasn't wrong. And again, it's not the fact that prices went down or up, and I take no joy in giving him a hard time. I've spoken to him quite a lot. He's quite a decent guy. I don't always agree with him, but you know, the error was not allowing for the fact that things may not turn out the way he expected them to, because he had such conviction that if the analysis he'd done was right, then therefore that must happen. He just didn't allow for those alternatives and put himself in a position where, you know, he and again, he's perfectly fine. But that idea of drawing a conclusion, if you have a view of geopolitics or technology or something, and you are so convinced that you throw all your eggs in that basket, be very, very, very careful, because if this doesn't work out that way, you're in a world of hurt.
Oh yeah, 100%, 100%.
Mate, we'll move quickly through this. We have got a couple of things to get to. Quote, our goal at Berkshire is simple. We want to own either all or a portion of businesses that enjoy good economics, that are fundamental and enduring. Within capitalism, some businesses will flourish for a very long time, while others will prove to be sinkholes. Then he goes on to say, quote, it's harder than you would think to predict which will be the winners and losers. And those who tell you they know the answer are usually either self-delusional or snake oil salesmen, end quote. Mm. Which actually probably just reinforces the thing we've just said before. I don't think I've got much more to add on that other than Buffett does it with his usual flair, a very, very simple way to do it.
Yep. And he's previously defined the best business as one that generates large amounts of free cash flow that can be reinvested at high rates of return, yep. which is a bit of a word salad, and to throw it at you very quickly like that, it takes a little bit to absorb that. But it's just basically a company that can sustain its operations without having to continually reinvest into just the existing operations.
Yep.
So it throws up all this spare money, what we call free cash flow. And then actually I can not pay it out as a dividend, I can keep it. And I've got this little opportunity here where I can invest that and get 20, 30% rates of return. You do that all day long and do that for decades, you end up being like Warren Buffett. So yeah, he's got a good formula. Very easily outlined, very difficult to prosecute, but very, very elegant and very correct too.
Nice. This is interesting too, mate, think about the way people invest. Quote, though the stock market is massively larger than it was in our early years, today's active participants are neither more emotionally stable nor better taught than when I was in school. For whatever reasons, markets now exhibit far more casino-like behavior than they did when I was young. The casino now resides in many homes and daily tempts the occupants. This should be tattooed on people's faces or put at the bottom of their, you know, if you're a decent stockbroker, this would be your login screen. Now they're not, because they make money doing it, right? Well, but that's that idea of somehow that, you know, we talk about technology and the advances in technology. I've said many, many times, our biggest challenge is our brains haven't evolved as quickly as our society has, whether that's the economy more broadly or technology in particular. And we are bringing a knife to a gunfight of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that marketers and business people looking to make a buck from us, not for us, can create these casinos in our pockets. You know, they're not poker machines, so somehow they seem more respectable and more reasonable. And it's investing, it's not speculating, it's not gambling, I'm buying and selling shares. Maybe it's better to say it is the function, not the form, that defines casino-like behavior.
Yeah, I'll point to the GameStop movie again, Dumb Money. It just demonstrates that so well, right? It's a good thing. I mean, just to be selfish again for a moment, you know, in the sense that it means that there can be really big perturbations from a reasonable notion of fair value because of over exuberance and then over anxiety, if you want to call it that. So yeah, long may it last.
Nice. Last one, mate. There's two here. I'll do two. I don't care. Quote, we cherish their presence. This is what Xiao is talking about. We cherish their presence and believe they are entitled to hear every year both the good and the bad news delivered directly from their CEO and not from an investor relations officer or communications consultant forever serving up optimism and syrupy mush. End quote.
Strong agree.
That's cool, isn't it?
No one's going to do it. No one's going to do it.
But also,
it'll be the exception to the rule, but it is, yeah.
Yeah. Remember, as an investor, that's what you're getting. You're getting optimism and syrupy mush from almost every company you see report and talk about their business. So discount it accordingly. Last one, quote, the lesson from Coke and Amex, when you find a truly wonderful business, stick with it. Patience pays, and one wonderful business can offset the many mediocre decisions that are inevitable. Which again is pretty much exactly what you said before.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, you and I have both been in this industry for a while, and I think when we've ever had to deal with a client who is unhappy, and you're dealing with money, it's just going to, no matter how good you are.
Yeah.
It usually people. I think and this is true in life in general, I think it's usually a mismatch in expectations versus the reality of things. So everyone says, I like this share market thing. I feel as though the long-term average return of 10% is better than what I'm getting elsewhere. It's got a lot of advantages. It's super easy to do, low cost, fast settlement, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, I'm down for that. Not recognizing the reality is that, well, within that, you know, probably 4 to 7 of your investments are not, out of 10 investments are not going to work out. It's going to be a minority that do all the heavy lifting, and it's never going to be 10% a year. It's going to be up 30% and then down 40%, but it's going to average that 10%. Mm. And I think it's just worth sort of stressing here that, as you said before, even someone like Buffett is going to make all kinds of mistakes, but just to remember that, hey, this is normal. This is, don't get upset. And the worst thing you can do, And it's hard to sort of give this advice to a client because you are inherently self-interested in the sense that it's like, well, I don't want the client to go. So I'm going to, you know, it feels as though you're saying what you have to say to sort of keep them. But
that's right.
But I think it's the truth. You know, it's sort of like it's going back to that earlier point of sort of it being much more of a casino. The incentives at play are very interesting here. And we've talked about this before. You and I set up an advisory service. We go, we're not going to be different from everyone else. And our marketing is going to say, hey, come invest in the stock market. Super scary, hyper volatile. You'll watch your net wealth jump around by huge orders of magnitude from time to time. A lot of the investments will go bad, but we think over the long, long term, you'll do very, very well. Here you go, $200 a year membership. No one's signing, not a single person on God's green earth is signing up. The person who says, hey, look at this one. This one's going to the moon. You need to get on this now. And here's some other ones that we've won. They almost, the industry selects for the bad actors because the bad actors just have such better marketing because they're more prepared to give you that rose colored sort of view of things. The trouble with it is it's this churn and burn of customers. People get wrecked, they still make their money, and it becomes this insidious, horrible kind of industry. Whereas, you know, hopefully with some of the stuff we're sort of putting out there, we can just hammer home these more difficult messages and still hopefully get through to people that, but it's still worth it. It's worth it despite the agony.
Yeah, love it, mate. Love it. I'm going to finish, mate, with a rant. Can I rant? I haven't ranted publicly for a while.
Please, that's not a podcast if we don't rant.
Coles reported its earnings this week. Woolies last week. We talked about Woolies results last week. And I even ranted about this a little bit last week. I am so sick and tired of the absolute BS that goes around the alleged price gouging by our supermarkets. It is just absolute and complete nonsense by people who, frankly, either do know better and are cynically using it to make a political or social point, or don't know better but should, and I'm not entirely sure which one of these is wrong. I've done the numbers, Ram. Here's the thing. Let's take Woolies' profit for the last 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Add Coles' profits for the last 6 months.
Net profit? Then
multiply them by two to get a yearly number.
Okay. Sorry, net profit that, are we talking about? Is that what we're just again? Make? We're talking about net profit?
Net profit.
Okay, yep.
Divide that by the number of Australians.
Mm-hmm.
Then divide that by the number of weeks in a year. Mm-hmm. To have Woolies and Coles within 5 minutes drive of 95, 98, 99 probably percent of Australians with fresh food, big range, great service, cheap prices, $2.17 per person per week. We pay more for Netflix. Now, I don't know what they think is going to happen here. If Coles and Woolies profits halved, we'd save a buck a week per person. I live in a family of three people. I would save $150 on groceries, which frankly would be lovely, and I would take it and that'd be fine. There is no profiteering when I've got to pay at my household $300 a year over and above the cost of providing all of this great stuff, the range, the service, the price, the location, the convenience. I can pick it up from the store. I can have it delivered to my house. $2.17 a week per person in profit from Woolies and Coles. And I just, mate, for the life of me, I don't know, well, I suspect I do know why, but the absolute, I'm going to say stupidity of people who either, as I said, should know better but don't, which is indefensible, or do know better and don't care, which is indefensible, or should know better, haven't bothered to find out because they like the idea of blaming these grocers for profiteering, is just completely mind-blowingly stupid. We have a dozen different problems in Australia. Big problems. You've talked about housing. We've talked about housing before. We've talked about resources taxation. We've talked about multinational tax avoidance. We've talked about all of that. We've not talked about a whole lot of other stuff that's a problem as well. Productivity, maybe, treasurer and lobby group and newspaper journos. It is just absolutely freaking nonsense, the carry-on that we hear about a profit margin that is $2 per person per week, that if it halved would be fine, but hardly move the dial. It is just so incredibly frustrating. We've just talked about the mortgage cliff. We just talked about at the beginning of the program, the fact that 1.6 million Australians are in mortgage stress. What is government doing about any of that? Nothing. But there's four or five different inquiries about grocery prices because somehow Woolies and Coles are the biggest problem we have as a country. Now, yes, we can do more than one thing at a time. Yes, we can do an inquiry into grocery prices and other stuff, but we're not doing the other stuff. And the number of tweets from the people who should know better, the number of public pronouncements from politicians and lobby groups who should know better, the number of journos who get caught up in this rubbish and think that somehow they should know better. Shout out to The Guardian, by the way, a paper that I genuinely quite like, but has been running this Australia versus UK grocery margin story for God knows how long, and obviously paid by the story. It drives me absolutely bananas that given every problem we've got, given every opportunity we've got, given the challenges, given the things that our governments and a serious interested media and really, really smart people working for think tanks and lobby groups could actually be doing, they're spending all this time and effort on absolute nonsense. Mm. I don't know. You go. I'll shut up.
I totally take the point, and I agree with you that it's a storm in a teacup. It gets way more attention than it should. But I'll push back a little bit, and maybe I'll repeat some of the stuff I said last week, but just the terms gouging, the terms profiteering,
mm-hmm.
are they doing that? Well, I don't know what the formal definition of that is. Like, as I said, there's a semantic angle to this. As a free market capitalist, I guess I would say that a company should make as much profit as it can make, as long as it operates within the rules of law,
sure.
As we have it. So I don't know where. Yeah, look, object. Let's just go with some objective facts. There's always a nugget of truth to some of these things. Gross margins increased. Right, they just did. So yes, the prices that Coles and Woolies had to pay for their suppliers went up. They passed that on, and then they added more than what they normally do. So that's fact. All right. Now again. Could they do that? Yes, they clearly could. Should mm-hmm. they do that? Well, shouldn't they? It depends on what you think the mandate of the board and management is. If we want to have a discussion on sort of limiting the profitability of certain industries, I think it's a very slippery slope. It's a very dangerous kind of slope. But I do get the argument that's like, well, you did clearly pass on more than your added costs. I know there are things below the bottom line.
Added product cost, just to be really clear, because their net margins actually fell as well.
Yeah, but then you especially in the, I didn't look at Coles, but in the case of Woolies, though, that's with Big W and stuff in it. They're in, mm-hmm. EBIT operating margins increased for supermarkets. So, and again, I'm sort of stating, two things can be true at once. I'm stating a fact, right? Like, So starting with the premise that, it's completely overblown because the numbers that we're talking about are not going to move the dial for me at all. So I get that, but just to be pedantic and argue the point, you passed on more, all right? And in your supermarkets division, you made more money. My broader point is, well, if we don't think that's okay, what do we do about it?
Yeah.
And I think mandating things just very quickly sends us in a direction economically that's very dangerous. And, you know, you get to breadlines and all kinds of stupidity very, very quickly in that regard. I've long been on the record of saying, you know, competition is the solution, you know, to these kinds of things. But these companies have incredible market power. They just do. And it's a motive. So I get the story. I would far prefer the journos focus on much more important things. There's an element of truth to what they're saying. It's just overblown. I guess that's my point.
Fair enough.
Right, because it is. Because like the margins are the margins are the margins.
Yeah.
And they went up. And they sit 50% higher than where they sit in the US and the UK.
Yep.
Fact. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Different conversation. How do you fix it? Different conversation. Does it deserve all the attention? No, it doesn't.
I just think that the savings you could make by, so you know, Woolies gross margin went up 25 basis points, right? So that's that a 2% increase would be 2 cents in the dollar. A 0.2% is 0.2 of a cent in the dollar. Let's either give that back and the gross margins are fine. What difference? It's just the dollars per person per Australian or whatever. It's just such a stupid argument relative, as you say, the numbers are the numbers. But relative to every other problem we've got, the number of column inches, radio talkback time, politicians ranty time, lobby groups carry on. Let's say we made them give it back. Okay, so the average Australian would be a tiny, 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 tiny fraction better off. Well done, guys. Congratulations. You solved the biggest problem we've got. Everything's okay now. Australia's now much more prosperous, much more better off. Thank you very much for all that hard work. You've done your job. You can go back right off into the sunset.
Yep.
It is just, you know, look at the profits made by energy companies. Look at the issues with productivity. Look at the budget situation. Look at resource taxation. Look at the lack of again, there's so many. And even if you disagree with all of those things, you'll have another five things you think we should do.
Yep.
And almost none of those things are going to be, grocery margin is not going to be more impactful to anybody than any of those things. It is just this nonsense conversation. It's either misunderstanding or misdirection. And either way, it is just so ridiculously useless. Here's the other thing, by the way, mate. I've said this before. I think I said this last week too. You know how they're making that money? By screwing the suppliers, not by screwing the customers.
Mm.
The simple, I've worked for food suppliers. I worked for half a dozen of them earlier in my career. Can I tell you, it is not, you know, the consumer's not, when Coles and Woolies did the $1 milk campaign, it wasn't the consumer getting screwed. When they dropped the price of bread, it wasn't you and I paying too much. They are absolutely taking, if the margins are too high, and this is the other problem that frustrates me, mate, is, you know, what is it, lies down, lies statistics.
Mm.
The margins are higher. Yeah, they are. Do you know why they're higher? Now, I can't say for sure, because there's no way to absolutely pull us apart. But the pressure they put on large and small suppliers, I've worked for large multinationals. The pressure they put on these large suppliers, let alone the poor small guys, is just phenomenal. I would bet a very large amount of money that if we broke up Woolies and Coles into three or four parts each, the margins would go down. And everyone would say, hey, the margins are good, that's great. You know why they would go down? Because the food prices would go up and the suppliers would get paid more. And frankly, they probably should be paid more because they're getting screwed.
Mm.
But this is the outcome here is not the consumer getting taken for a ride. This is the suppliers having to put their hand in their pocket, or frankly, having other hands put in their pockets to fund this stuff.
Yep.
I don't own shares. Do I own shares in any suppliers? I don't think so. I don't know. Anyway, it's not about me. Not about my. I've worked for both. As I said, I've worked for Woolies. I work for the suppliers. I've been on both sides of this conversation.
Mm.
It is just like, you know, using a percentage margin, saying therefore it must be true that X is happening. As you say, mate, the numbers are the numbers. There's no argument about what the number is.
Yeah.
The lack of serious consideration and thought and interpretation of this in any objective way, rather than I have a preconception, let me prove it to you.
Yep.
It's just the standard public debate on this stuff is so low, it's crazy.
Yes, you're right. And I guess what I will legitimize is people, I think, are right to be angry. I think take it to the average person in the street kind of perspective here.
Hmm.
And you can talk all you want about margins and competition and regulation and all the rest. All I know is that over the last few years, my purchasing power has gone down a lot.
Yes.
I go to the supermarket and petrol and things that are in my face every day. There's only so much money coming in and a hell of a lot more is going out. And I'm not buying more stuff.
Yep.
Everything. Yep. So that anger is legitimate. And then you say, well, why is that? And you say, well, let's sit down for a 14-week seminar and we'll go through some very detailed monetary theory. And, you know, it's very hard to grasp. So I do want to legitimize the anger that people have. And I honestly think if people had a better grasp of, well, why is it my life getting harder, there would be riots in the street. But it's so hard to see. And I don't think anyone clearly sees it because it is so nebulous and complicated and dynamic. Yep. And I don't want to... Please don't think that I'm saying, oh, I see what everyone else doesn't see. I've got my opinion like everyone else does. But it is so difficult. But I feel it's... It's a bit of a, not a deliberate switch and bait and switch, but it is, I think there'd be a lot of parties that are glad that the supermarkets and Qantas are copping all the heat, when maybe the more influential factors behind this phenomena is just no one's looking at, and they're thinking, good, don't let that, you cop all the blame. So it is a bit of a frustration that we don't have more mature, broader, deeper conversations about, well, why is everything seemingly getting worse for so many people? What are the root causes and what can we do about it? A supermarket inquiry is not going to fix that, right? It's not. Printing up squillions of dollars and giving everyone, regardless of their personal financial situation, you know, vouchers for their kids to do swimming lessons and that kind of nonsense, particularly the states did and everywhere else. And in the US, handing everyone a $1,600 stimulus check. It's just sort of like there are consequences to these actions. And we're taking our medicine in a lot of ways. Now, I'm not saying they're the only factors, but they're big factors. But they're the factors that no one talks about, which I find frustrating.
It is just, yes. And I feel better having had a rant, mate. Just, if you, yeah, you care about public policy, yeah, you'll ask people to actually do stuff that matters. And, you know, is this, as I say, is there a kernel of truth here? Yes. Are the numbers real? Yes. Is it anything close to the biggest issue or sizable issue that everyone's talking about? No.
No.
What's happening? Talkback hosts and politicians and journos are grandstanding. Those who hate profits are grandstanding because they think they can possibly get away with it because maybe there's a groundswell here and they can make their political points or their ideological points.
Yep.
There is very, very, very little in the way of someone objectively saying, I have really seriously thought about the challenges facing the Australian economy and society, and this one is the one we should talk about because this is the one that if we fixed would have the biggest impact on Australians. It is just absolute nonsense.
As an aside, this is why difficult economic times are so dangerous, not just because of the impact it has on our well-being, but it just leads to political populism. That's what you're saying, right? It's a populist kind of response to this where, you know, we 500 years ago, we all would have grabbed our pitchforks and marched up to the castle with torches in our hands, right? Like, and now we're sort of doing it and railing on social media. But it is, there's a lot of anger. It's just very poorly directed, I guess. Yeah, I don't know.
I agree. I feel better now. Mate, will you come back on Sunday? Can we talk about some other things that maybe our listeners have raised for us to chat about instead?
I always really enjoy the mailbag episode. So yeah, let's give a shout out for more questions to come through as well.
We shall do that. By the way, quick heads up, there might be something special in the works. I can't say too much just yet. Suffice it to say, if you think the pod machine is cool, imagine if you could have this podcast without the pod machine. That sounds weird. That sounds interesting. I wonder if people... I can't say anything else. All right, I'm leaving it there. See you on Sunday. Until then, full on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.